if this was perfect, it wouldn't be.
Hello, this is Pedro the Permit, and thank you for listening to the Scalf Podcast. I know I sure as hell would never listen to it, but enjoy it while it lasts.
Hey, this is Sam Bailey with Southern Culture on the Fly magazine. This is the Scoffcast. Tonight we're going to be talking about the 50th issue. And we have John Agricola. We have Declan Rogers, other known as Gecko. We have Eli. We have Dr. Chocolate. And we have Alan Broyhill here. So we're going to turn it over to Alan and start this thing off.
Community.
Drink.
For those of you that don't know, we have a rule here. If the word community is used, we all drink.
And yes, we are bringing this podcast to you from the Embassy Suites in Duluth, Georgia.
We rented a room just to do it all over again.
Yeah, we had an Airbnb, but we also rented a room at the hotel just to record the podcast. Just for continuity's sake.
It's really just for Paul.
I miss Paul.
Oh, we forgot about Ryan. Ryan's somewhere in this embassy suite.
Ryan Stevens is currently doing things that we don't really understand.
He'll be in here in just a minute.
He might be being Irish right now. I'm not sure.
Nobody's that Irish.
So I think the only people that folks don't know would be Declan and Eli. Declan, who are you?
What's going on? I'm Declan. I met John through Instagram. in a normal way.
Sliding them DMs.
Yeah, we ended up going on some trips and whatnot, and got a few invites back, so I'm here now in Georgia catching no fish with them again, and it's been great.
Declan's a talented photographer, and we appreciate his work as Gecko for the first four issues. He contributed 3 out of 4 of those, I think.
Yeah.
So a lot of the visuals are part of Declan's craft.
And Eli, who the heck are you?
Howdy, folks. I'm a fisheries biologist during the day and Hank Hershey's private fishing guide by night. I know most of these guys from time spent in Alabama chasing different species of aquatic life. From ducks to fish to whatever it may be. Every once in a while, they find it in their hearts to feature some of my photos in their fantastic magazine. So I'm here along for a fishing trip, and they asked me to be a part of this.
And I met Eli less than 48 hours ago. Greeted me with a Modelo. Nice guy.
Eli's really just here because he has one of the greatest belly laughs of all time. If you hear Eli laugh, you will laugh. It's just, it's what happens.
That's right. I'm a walking, talking laugh track.
Well, I think we should start it off with that we're talking about the 50th issue. And one of my good friends from Arkansas, which we don't get a ton of content from Arkansas. So if you're Arkansas folks out there and you have something, let us know.
Peak Suey.
But Steve Daly at Steve Daly Outfitters did some pretty dope photos for us. He's been collecting them for years. I don't think he knew that they were going to end up in Scoff by any means. But it's kind of a cool story. So Steve goes down to Louisiana often during the wintertime. You guys know what happens there in the wintertime, Big Reds. And that would be what most people would probably focus on. But Steve has an eye that's a little bit different, and he started keying in on all these old fish shacks. And he would be better off, obviously, to tell this. But over the past, I'm going to say 5+ years, he's been taking photos of these fish shacks that have been hurricane and saltwater destroyed and just dilapidated. And it is beautiful, really. Some black and white, some color, but how many pictures were in that file, Hank? There's a ton.
He has a huge collection.
Huge.
What struck me the most about Steve's photo essay was that you didn't really get a sense of tragedy from any of the photos. Like you see a lot of photos of like hurricane wreckage and things like that. But Steve's photos, I mean, for maybe it says more about the fish shack's original integrity than anything else. But like, I don't know, just seeing them sink, like seeing them sink and, you know, dilapidate further just made them seem like more a part of their environment. You know, like it's like the marsh is like reclaiming everything in what felt like a very natural way because of Steve's portrayal.
Now, was he doing this as a re-photography project where he's re-visualizing the
file names?
That wasn't really clear
exactly
in the magazine, but I think in the portfolio that he sent, you could see the same structures under degradation.
You can recognize, if you look in the photo essay, you can recognize the same shack, but from different angles.
Right.
Like, there are certain characteristics of each one, like the wrought iron, you know, grating over the windows.
Color.
The 3B's shack.
Yeah.
The, you know, some of them, like, their name is painted on the side of it. You
right.
It's just
sometimes when you let images speak for themselves, people don't understand exactly. So I wanted to clarify that's what he's doing intentionally, is re-photographing the same structures in the harsh environment of the salt
over years. I think it's five plus years. He's been going down there for a while. I wish I had that exact number, but it's pretty sweet.
And the marsh itself is one of those places that's disappearing in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah,
it's not just the structures, it's the mud traps and the Spartina grass and all that. So it's a really cool idea as an art thing.
Ryan Gary talks a lot about the changes of the marsh in Louisiana in an article he wrote actually for the Hank's Bait Shop blog about duck hunting down there. He's been going duck hunting at this old fish shack forever. And he talks about, like, last year we drove around this corner and there was grass everywhere, and this year there is no grass. I mean, it's remarkable. What do they lose, like, a couple football fields of marsh, like, a day.
It's like Detroit losing.
Really?
No, it's like it is insanely fast.
A day.
Yeah.
Not all in the same place.
No, I mean, it's spread out. It's like an average over the entire state. But
it's a day.
And that,
a football field a day.
That also, you know, encompasses probably some of the marshes in Mississippi, some of the marshes in Texas. But
that's wild.
Yeah, it's not good.
Just like those fish shacks. They lose a fish shack a day, folks.
Are some cool.
You want to talk about here, like, beyond just the fish shacks, like, that's some of the most ecologically important habitat out there anywhere, is those Gulf Coast marshes. So something we should all be thinking about.
Eli, you speak like you know something about that.
What can you say?
He's only a fisheries biologist.
What are they doing though? Is it filtering? I mean, like, I really don't know science. So, like,
so they provide a whole host of services, from filtering, mm-hmm, for sure, and then storm buffering is a huge one. Okay. So they can absorb a lot of your flood tides and whatnot. And we can try to control water through different means, but water is one of the most powerful things on the planet, you know, and the natural way of controlling it is probably the best.
Yeah.
It's always been doing its thing for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Steve, for taking those photos and letting us use them. Let's see. He's Arkansas. If you want to go fishing, Steve Daly Outfitters on the White. He's an awesome dude. I've for years, my personal best brown trout I caught on Steve's boat. Saw a guy.
Nighttime?
Daytime.
Snagged it.
Yeah.
Triple hooks.
It actually wrapped itself up in my leader. It barrel rolled, caught it underneath the dock. It was 27 and a half, ate a streamer, and just barrel rolled itself in 20 pound.
Perfect.
I know. It was kind of
a better situation.
It kind of sucked. Like, I really wanted that big fish to fight more, and it just didn't.
Have you ever heard of the Indiana dry fly?
No.
It's a technique used in Indiana to catch very large trout. It's kind of an easy pattern to make, actually. You take about a 1/0 treble hook and you dip it in lead, and then you pull it out let the lead cool, and you dip it again, and you just sort of keep dipping until it's, I don't know, about 3-4 ounces, and then you just throw it at a steelhead, and if it doesn't knock it out on impact, then just snag it and reel it in.
Are we doing something with our voices right now?
Sounds so much fun.
It was very bleak, Hank.
Do we have steelhead in Indiana?
There are steelhead in Indiana. There's steelhead in Indiana.
Exactly where. Drop me a pen.
I'm just saying that technique could work. That technique could work anywhere. It might work in Arkansas. I've never tried it.
I'm going to try it tomorrow for striper.
Good luck.
Moving on, John.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to talk about in this session was Gerard Velazquez's interview that we covered in the 50th issue, where it was a transcription. And we chose to do that because Jerry was sort of reticent about telling that story because I think he thought that it was embarrassing that he could have been on like this mission and failed in his mission. And I kind of got to know him over the course of a week, and very, very proud about the work he's done in Punta Allen and at the Palmetto Club. You know, he was sort of partly one of the guiding forces in the dual guide system on Pongas. And so, you know, education in English for a lot of those guides that are on the island was something that became important, but it's not systematized. It's one of those things that he's worked with them over the years, over maybe 20 or 30 years. And so we let the story about his Memento Mori photos just stand as he told it, because he was extremely capacious in the story itself. I wasn't interjecting a lot or guiding or steering him in his interview. It was just one of those things where he talked and we listened. And, it's a near-death thing. He's got sharks swimming under him. You know, he's taking pictures of them. The fear of death was meaningful in a real way. And one of the things that was lost was that we couldn't do the whole interview. And so I wanted to tell a little bit about this other story that he told, because it was sort of lost in the shuffle. He told a story that was interesting from a cultural relativism situation. Apparently some Japanese businessmen and a lady came to Palmetto Club, and the first year the lady did not catch a permit, and incidental to the story, she had a deformed arm. So she's trying to catch a permit with one arm. And the first year she was unsuccessful. And the second time she went back, she made it happen after a lot, like last hour of the last day. And the cultural relativism side is that the Japanese businessmen were so proud of this person for achieving her goal that she had worked on so much in Japan. And like every one of them went up and bowed to her. Like, you know, I think about, you know, that code in Japan of honor, you know, and the pinnacle of fly fishing is to catch a permit, which I've never done, you know, but she has done it. She's got one arm. You know, I saw recently on Jerry's Instagram page that an 89-year-old man caught a permit recently. So it's that similar, you know.
Makes me feel terrible.
I know, me
about
too.
Myself.
Me too. But I'm so happy for him because it was his first. So at age 89, like, I'm 40, so I'm not necessarily out of the game. You know,
if things are looking up, John.
If I continue to gain 20 pounds a year, who knows? But right now, I'm still in the game, you know. So
when you gain 20 pounds, I'll deform your arm, and then maybe you can get your permit.
I'm willing to try anything, Sam.
I'm just here for you.
Yeah.
How many casts at Permit have you made?
Let me tell the whole history of me with Permit.
No.
It doesn't take
that much time.
It doesn't take very long.
Okay.
So two trips I've dedicated to Permit. And the first one, the first shot I had, I flung my rod tip at the fish.
Like, the whole rod tip came off?
The whole rod tip came off. I mean, it would probably have been a terrible cast because I overpowered it. But at the same time, like, who knows? Like, it
could have eaten.
Later that same trip, I talked to one for about 10 minutes casting to the same permit, like, multiple times. And it was really fun. But then at Palmetto Club, the weather was really difficult in December, and I only saw maybe 3 or 4 fish in one space. So, like, I see this nearly hallucinatory image that felt like an oasis or some delirious, like,
you know, had that haze kind of, like,
they're just floating
the
in
heat,
space.
Yeah,
and just
like
finning. And, never like, I'm one. Like, oh, my God, I've never, you know, I've seen it in video before, but never in person. And I saw that, and I just lost my mind. I had buck fever so bad, I was with my line hand dropping the line, and, you know, I muffed it. And that was the only chance I got. So those are my 2 or 3 chances.
Well, if you ever quit getting that feeling, just quit going.
Whenever you go fishing for permit, let me know.
No, I'm saying if you quit getting that feeling,
quit going. I'm saying
for real.
When you go.
Oh, yeah. No, I want to go. But I'm saying if you quit having that
we're
feeling.
We're going to go next year.
Sweet.
Let's go.
All right. I'm down.
Yes, right. I'm in.
Florida Keys.
That was an open invite.
I can't
invite
wait
to
be
us,
John
right?
at soccer.
Nacho. Baracho.
So that's all that I would say about the Mamini Mori article. I mean, it was just incredible to listen to somebody with that much expertise and experience talk about his life in guiding and the most momentous moments of that.
As cool as that was to read it, I wish I could have heard him tell the story.
You can. There's a video of it.
Okay, I haven't seen the video.
Yeah, you could read the transcription too.
Yeah, well, I did read the transcription. I read that one.
We have videos of it, but the audio's kind of hard, so we decided to transcribe it.
Okay. Yeah, it's yeah.
Maybe one day we'll
still
we'll upload that to the.
You're
archives.
Saying there's a chance.
You're saying there's a chance.
You mentioned that last hour of the last day. I mean, talk about how you want to do it, right? I can't tell you how many trips you go on where you can tear them up for the first day, and then you got 6 days of crap afterwards, mm-hmm. and you go home thinking it was a terrible trip. But I mean,
you got to see it.
Yeah,
you saw.
But if you go the whole trip and you don't catch anything, and that last day you get a trip saver,
yeah,
those trips are the best ones.
It's all about perspective.
I quit judging my trips on fish caught a long time ago.
That's fair. That's fair.
My first time permit fishing, I got struck by lightning.
Maybe you should not go anymore.
And I also did not get your permit.
Is that why are you like tingly from that? You can't just leave that hanging out there. You got struck by lightning on a boat?
I'm not right. You know, it's never the same.
Like directly struck
no,
by
so
lightning.
This was my first time ever at a fishing lodge. It was my interview for Bahio. They're like, come to this lodge and meet us. I had never saltwater fly fished. So it was my first day saltwater fly fishing. And yeah, we went out there and we're on this little panga. It's got one of those metal grab bars up front.
Yeah.
Got caught in a crazy storm, and normally they just stake out, you know, they don't run from storms. They're like, hey, it'll just blow right over. And it did blow right over, but the lightning came down, struck the top of this grab bar, came down, and then where the grab bar meets the hull, it like arced together and made this little like fireball.
Mm.
Like all the life jackets and stuff are supposed to be like, you know, fire retardant. They're just on fire. It's totally on fire. And I was with that dude, Matt Porbay, who now owns the No Name Lodge. And we're both there yelling at each other, like, super deaf. You know, it's a very loud experience.
Did you get the tingles?
Yeah, it was bad. It was actually, like, pretty, like, euphoric. Like, the ride home was, like, best I've ever felt in my life. I was like, man, that was awesome, you know.
Do you think there was some kind of magical transfer that was made at that point that's made you into who you are?
I don't. I mean, I was casting way further after that, but socially, you know what I mean. I've never recovered.
That's where Gecko came from.
My hearing, the kid in the back of the car. What?
I got buzzed on a blue line one time, but I didn't get struck like that. I felt it come down the creek. It was one of those little pop up storms. That's wild.
It was cool.
That's just God's way of uploading new talents to you.
Zap. Well, now I feel like I'm straight. Like, now when I'm in a big storm, I'm like, I am the kid that can go run across the field because I already got whacked. You know, exactly. What I mean?
You can like, go play golf.
Yeah,
man.
Statistically, like everyone else should run, but like I'm chilling. You know what I mean? Like, I'm untouchable, and at least for a while.
Yeah. We hope you never get struck by lightning again.
That's all.
All right, where are we going next? John's done.
So we talked about Jerry's Memento Mori. I believe sometime after that we had, because me and Scott's stories came before that, I think.
Yeah.
But we had Flip's photo essay. In addition to Steve. So we had two photo essays for the first time. And Flip's photos are cool for two reasons. One, they're great photos.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reason is that he is not a fishing photographer.
Yeah.
Flip is one of the most famous skiing photographers ever. Like, dude traveled the world on ski tours, like professional, you know. There's a really good interview with Flip online, actually. Just if you Google Flip McCririck, McCririck, and find his interview online. It's like on it's like some kind of artist's blog, but most Google Chrome browsers flag the website as unsafe. Just
it's fine.
It's fine. It's not going to infect your computer with...
Hank promises. It's fine.
But the interview is so cool because he talks about his career in skiing. And then you look at his photos in Scoff, mm-hmm. and it's like, okay, I get it. They're high action. They're very, like, there's a lot of motion. There's a lot of, like... You could tell it's like a sports photographer's take on fly fishing, sure. right? Like... People approach the sport from different angles. Like, there's the meditative angle. There's the, you know, the therapeutic angle. There's the artistic angle. And then there's, like, the fuck it. Let's, you know, like, there's the X Games, like.
The adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, the adrenaline junkie approach to fly fishing. And that's totally Flip. Like, all he cares about is permit fishing. The dude goes to Punta Allen, like, for a couple weeks every year. And he's incredible. He's caught a lot of fish. But his background is all in skiing.
I think his photos brought out a lot of character of the folks he was around too.
Yeah.
That was one thing I appreciated about it. Looking through that whole set was, and there was a lot more than what we were able to put in the magazine, a lot more. And, you know, what you get through there is that high action for sure, but also the character of the folks around him. And I appreciate that about a photographer.
Yeah, the joy of the guides, the joy of fishing, really. Mm-hmm. It really just comes through in the photography. I love that.
Can you dive into that a little more and maybe expand on what makes permit fishing specifically so enticing?
I've never been permit fishing, so yeah, I'll pass
well, maybe
it on.
We are talking a lot about permit tonight, yeah. aren't we?
What I will say is that it is the adrenaline junkie thing, because when it's that thing that is in the rare air, the thing that you rarely see, you know, that's what jacks you up. I mean, you all will see it someday. And it will it'll probably ruin your brain, you know, the first time you see it.
Is it like a, I mean, is it, you called it buck fever.
Yeah.
Is it a lot like,
I mean, normally I don't feel like I'm a terrible caster, but in that moment, that second or third time that I saw a permit, it didn't seem like I knew how to cast at all.
The only thing my brain can equate that to is musky. Same, yeah. I see a lot of folks screw up musky. Just even just the visuals. The first time you see one, you just stop.
Yeah.
Most people freeze. Most people that see their first fish, they just freeze. They're moving the fly. The fish gets behind it, and they just are like, "Oh shit, that thing's there." I didn't think that was ever gonna happen. And then if the fish just happens to stick around, there's no way the figure eight turns out right. Which would be like my back cast on a permit. The four, I'd be like, get one off. My first back cast, I'd screw the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that interests me about fishing versus hunting is that, like, screwing up doesn't have, like, ethical ramifications.
Mm-hmm.
If you screw up in hunting, you just killed something that you cannot honor by eating it. Or, like, finding it and eating it. Or, you know, you wounded it and ruined its life forever. But with fishing, it's like, oh, I just missed it. You know, it's not like...
And let me take that just a little further. Because what you're talking about is the sort of oxymoron that is buck fever.
Yeah.
Because,
what's, like, the parallel?
Well, in fishing, it's different because... You have to make that fish engage your thing.
Mm.
You don't have to do that to a deer.
Well, you do lure deer.
He's got to engage with my pile.
Yeah, my pile of corn's got to be just right. But no, I mean, what I'm saying is, I'm not an archer, so it's hard for me to talk about that side of it. But, I know that the permit fish, I cast to it for 10 minutes that one time that I engaged with it. He didn't want to eat. He was there. I talked to him. We had an exchange, and then it was gone. Very ethereal, you know, with shooting a buck. If you're not a 12-year-old and you've shot a buck before, you're probably going to get that buck, you know. I mean, I know 12-year-olds that get scared, and I get scared too, but I don't know. It's just controlling your breathing. I mean, I don't know. I mean, for
is it that? But it's not. Is it the same thing for permit though? Like,
it probably is.
Were you the 12-year-old that had never seen a
permit?
But
I'm from Alabama, not Mexico, so I've seen more bucks than I've seen permit.
Exactly. So maybe your jitters with the permit as a 30-something-year-old were maybe similar to the jitters a 12-year-old would experience seeing a 12-point buck for the first time.
It turns you into a 12-year-old. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Where are we going from here? Sam was just looking through the magazine. What you got?
Fly shop desert story.
The fly shop dessert story.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one.
I really love that.
Yeah.
That was a really good story.
Talk about it for a second, Sam?
So the fly shop desert to me was really cool because I thought about how lucky I was to have a fly shop in, you know, my vicinity. You know, I didn't realize how hard people in Auburn had it kind of going to, you know, Birmingham and, you know, a couple of hours out from a fly shop. That makes it hard because you got to order, you got to plan. I mean, when I want to go, I want to go. I mean, I'm going to go to the store and go.
Yeah, I've lived kind of both sides of it, multiple sides of it. I've lived where there's a fly shop right there in town. I've lived where it was, you know, an hour and a half to my nearest fly shop. And I've also been the fly shop. So it really touched me. It touched me because of that. I've seen it from so many different angles, and I just, I don't know, you don't hear people talking about it that much, and how, you know, how much a fly shop means to people. One thing Scott and I have talked about in the past so much is that, you know, a fly shop for me and for him, it is our bar. I don't go to my local pub and sit down and drink. I like to go to a fly shop and tie flies, bullshit with the guys there, talk fish and tell lies. That's our bar. That's always my bar. And so when you don't have that, it really sucks. So, you know, in Georgia, we're pretty fortunate. We have some really great fly shops, you know, around. And my local fly shop moved a few years ago. It was Cahutta, and they moved up to Blue Ridge. So they're a little over an hour from me now. And Alpharetta is another one that was, you know, it's not that far from me. And I used to work in Alpharetta, so they were kind of a local to me. And so I'm still able to get by there some. But I miss having it 5 minutes away. Being able to stop by after work, have a beer, bullshit, talk about the latest, you know, fly rods, reels, whatever. I love that Scott said he's leaving note cards at the, you know, at the record store about the new Sage Excalibur. But no, it just touched. It just really did. It touched me because I think it's important that, you know, that we as the fly fishing community support our local fly shops so they are around, because
it sucks when they're not there.
It does. It really sucks when they're not there. And it's not like beating a dead horse, but it's the truth. When they're not there, it's tough. So.
Yeah.
You're also allowed to support more than one fly shop.
It's true.
100%. I support many.
You can be loyal to as many people as you want. Yes. Being loyal to a fly shop does not mean refusing to shop anywhere else. It just means continuing to shop at
local.
That shop.
Yeah, shop local. Anywhere I travel, I stop in fly shops. And Scott touched on that too. And it's one of those things, like, I don't, you know, I'm fairly fortunate, but I still buy stuff. I buy flies, you know, if I need some leader tippet material or, you know, a sticker, a hat, shirt, whatever it is. I'm trying to do that everywhere
I go. You don't tie flies. We all know that.
Well, I don't tie good flies, that's for sure. I haven't tied flies in a while.
Where's your vice at?
It's on the tie desk, but it's all in a corner because I'm having my basement redone.
Okay.
Just wait. When it's redone here in another, you know, year...
Who's hopefully redoing it? Nobody.
No, I've had contractors.
That's
in the house.
A good point, Hank.
I've had contractors in the house a lot here lately, and it is gonna be finished and nice. I did the original work, and then we had a flood.
That's why
house.
They're coming back. Yeah,
yeah. Well, the original work was kind of cool, but it was not very pretty. But it was rustic.
Yeah,
it's gonna be really.
I've been
nice
in your now. Basement once.
If you're not careful, you're gonna end up in my basement again.
I don't want to interrupt. But I just had a terrible realization. When I talked in this podcast about catching permit and fishing for permit, I didn't realize that my buddy Declan has caught a permit at X Flats. And it just dawned on me that we should ask Declan about his experiences with permit, if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
He didn't remember it because he got struck by lightning.
That's exactly right.
They felt bad for me. I guess the first day I caught one, we actually caught six. So I caught two.
We caught six.
We just put it on the table here. That he right.
Get him off the
podcast. I actually got to go.
I'm over the story.
We would get him off the podcast, but the person we hired to do that kind of thing is Declan. So.
Sorry. My only thing to add on the permit situation is, like, we all fish for, you know what I mean, redfish and that type of thing, where you kind of see them, you know, plucking around, you can sneak up on them.
Mm-hmm.
The permit thing, from my experience, is like you look for them all day. You get so fired up, like, you know, you're planning this trip 6 months out. Oh, we're going to go look for permit. Like you said, it's a 4-day trip. 3 of the days suck. You get 1 day to do it. You're looking all day. You don't see anything. And then all of a sudden, it's like kind of like a deer coming out of the woods type of thing. Like, oh, there they are. And like they're coming in hot and heavy. Like they're coming in pretty fast, like they're not really picking, like you're going to get one or two shots on this fish that's like cruising pretty good, and like you either make it happen and you catch it, or you're like, oh man, I just like waited 6 months to like throw my rod tip, but the tip was close to the fish.
Or you catch two of them.
Yeah, right. But it's like, I don't know, it's a luck of the draw thing, and definitely like finding the right fish, you know what I mean? Like you could throw out 100 of the wrong fish, but like you find that one that's doing it, and it's like your 12-year-old reference, like you could do it. Your 12-year-old could do it if it's like the right one that's doing it. So, but no, I'm very fortunate to get the permit shots, and I haven't been fly fishing very long, and I probably don't deserve that fish just because I haven't put in the work. You know what I mean? The lightning thing was cool, but you know,
I'm going to call you Powder from now on. because that movie's way before your time. Yeah. I just dated myself. Okay.
I got it.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, Declan, since we got you on here, why don't you tell everybody why you're here, who you are, remind everybody, and we had some questions for you.
So I linked up with John, I think, kind of right when, you know, y'all started to fire up the magazine and everything. Just like, hey, looks really cool. You know, I'd be happy to help. And I'm sort of young and in my career as well. So anything I could get, you know, out there with my name on it. With that said, in the beginning, I wasn't sure because I do work in the industry as far as like attaching my name to it. So I was like, I'll just shoot the photos and just give the credit to Gecko, which is what my friends called me in high school. It was a self-given nickname, so I don't think it counts, but I have some names that say Gecko or some shirts that say Gecko on them. But yeah, started shooting some photos. We did that float on the New River, got to meet some awesome people doing that. Got to slide on the Black Fly trip, which was super cool, and really awesome tarpon trip where we camped for like 5 days. Not too many fish. We did stumble upon a few, but just some super cool experiences. And, you know, for me, really awesome just to get out there and get the photos and try to get my name out there without getting it out there at all.
Yeah.
I'll say when John first came to us and was like, hey, man, I got this guy. He's sent us a message and he's like interested in doing photography. And I'm like, oh, we got a guy. We don't need another guy. We got Alan. We don't need another photographer. We're good right now, you know? And he's like, no, just trust me, just look at it. And you know, the first thing I remember looking at that you did was you were talking about getting back to fixing up an old boat and kind of getting into fishing. Like, you don't need a brand new boat. Do your old boat. And I remember you had a little, I think you had a piece that you wrote about that we read. And I just remember that from, that was like one of the first things I saw that you did. And it was really cool. And then I was like, okay, maybe this guy can do some stuff with this. It'd be pretty cool. And then obviously you came on the trip. We went musky fishing. Or was it musky? Did we give musky fishing? Did we really? I don't think they were
musky
real,
fishing.
But, but I mean, we had a great trip. And it was awesome meeting you. And I'm so glad that, you know, John, you know, said, hey, we need to bring this guy on because it's been a lot of fun getting to know you, and glad to have you on here.
Yeah, no, it's been awesome. We've had some pretty wild times so far.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. But I think you got something else going on with like little John boats and stuff too, right? Don't you?
So I'm very like pro sort of, I guess this is interesting, like in the fly fishing world, they call it DIY. And like in every other fishing sector, it's like no one says DIY. It's just assumed that you go and you catch your own fish. So I think that's super interesting. Like in the fly world, there's a lot of people that, you know, they only go on trips with guides to these exotic places. But in, you know what I mean, like the spin fishing world, it's like, you know, I've been on 2 guided trips in my life, but you don't say DIY. It's just assumed that like, hey, I went and I caught it myself. But I kind of hate sometimes the industry, like, you know, shoves it down your throat that you got to go to this lodge and got to pay this guide and you got to have this Hell's Bay and like all these like material things to catch the fish. When in reality, it's like, dude, you need a freaking canoe and an 8-weight. And I don't know if that's a good segue into the Kirk Mark story, but it's sort of like the whole fishing industry, right? Like you have the Omni sonar with the offshore stuff and you can spot fish 5,000 feet away. Then you got the live scope in the bass world where you can actively watch your lure fall to a fish and you see him eat it before you feel it. So like the Kirk Mark story was super cool because it's very like primitive, it's very fair chase, you know, you go, you shoot a bird, you use the feathers, you catch a redfish on a canoe. It's just very like analog in a world that's like, you know, just progressing to this like crazy digital, like at what point are we not even fishing, you know what I mean? And like catching a tailing redfish on a fly that you tied with a bird that you killed is like the way it should be. It's fair to the fish, you know, like, hey man, I tricked you. Like, I got you so bad. That's a bird's feather. You know, you see birds all the time. You probably see feathers floating. Like, I tricked you to think it was a fiddler crab. Not, hey, man, I saw you 5,000 feet away on my 90-foot Viking, and I put a live bonita in your face. Like, it's that to me is not fair chase in the same way. So
tell me a little bit about the fellow that took Kirk fishing. I remember the few times that I've snipe hunted before. We actually destroyed the environment afterwards. I was thinking, you know, this snipe thing, it's awesome, but let's get some puddle ducks in here. And, like, I totally messed up a habitat by accident. I mean, it wasn't much land. I mean, it was maybe 100 square, like 300 square feet. No, not that. That's not very much square feet. We're talking like 200 yards of a football field or something.
Right.
And there used to be snipe in it. We filled it in with water, and then they were gone. And so, like, when I was talking to Kirk about this story, I was like, you know, what are you going to do if the snipe are gone? And he's like, no, I got it, you know. And so, like, I kind of want to know a little bit about the guy that took him, and also, like, you know, anything else you can say about that.
So, the dude that took him, I'll say, we're all from Maryland, so his name's Pat, and then you got Kirk, and they're kind of like this, like, classic Eastern Shore waterman. Like, people would always say, oh, Maryland's not the South. And, like, where I'm from in Maryland is totally not the South. Like, I basically live in D.C., but where they're from totally is. It's, like, you got all these OG crabbers and, like, real watermen, you know, that, like, fish and hunt and everything. So Pat and Kirk are definitely sort of that, like, Eastern Shore vibe, you know what I mean? Like, that goes back hundreds of years. You got the Dead Rye skiffs. Like, there's so much history and culture there. But the kid that took him, Pat, yeah, he's just dialed. And he's kind of, like, this Gran Torino type dude. Like, he only fishes out of a canoe. The boat that's in all the photos skinny dipping is like this old Carolina skiff with a 50 Seahorse Johnson, but, like, you know he's going to catch him, like, wherever he goes. And you see him in his canoe and it's, like, intimidating. I'm fortunate enough to have, like, a nice skiff, but, like, you see him out there paddling around, you're like, dude, like, whatever he's on, you know what I mean? Like, I need to get that. Really good tire, too. He ties for all the local New Smyrna shops. But it was cool to see him in the article, and knowing that Kirk was coming down to New Smyrna for 2 or 3 days, like, him linking up with Pat, it's like, you know they're going to get on him. You know what I mean? Not only are they going to get on the birds, like, everything's going to go to plan. They're going to get on the birds. They're going to go. They're going to catch the fish. Like, I think they caught, you know, 5 or 6 fish. It wasn't like, oh, we luckily got one bird, and then we got one fish. It's like, I think they killed as many birds as they wanted, then went and slayed fish, and everything was wrapped up, and Kirk went home. Like, there were no problems, so.
And there was a little Epicurean cooking in it, too. They cooked the snipe breasts. That was pretty cool.
I heard they're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Never had one.
I've never eaten Kirk's food, but I know that's his specialty. Yeah, and it's super cool to, like, bring that to the fly fishing world. You know, everyone now is, like, everyone's a photographer, blah, blah, blah. It's, like, how many people are, like, chefs? And it's kind of like a weird thing to talk about too, like the killing of fish in fly fishing. So it's kind of like refreshing to have someone be like, hey, you can eat a fish that you catch. Just because you caught on fly doesn't mean you, like, have to always let it go. It's totally fine.
Is there
let him cook? No. No, another great reason we have Declan on is that Declan works with Bahio, and Bahio is an advertiser in the magazine, and they're a great partner with us. Came on, I guess, our second issue last year as an advertiser, and it's been really nice working with them. They make amazing glasses that we're all enjoying, and let Declan talk a little bit about what Bahio's got going on.
Yeah, tell me that thing that you told me earlier on the boat.
About, like, the lens technology.
Yeah, that thing.
White light. Blue light.
White light.
That thing.
That's new. No, you can't know about that. No, I don't know. I don't know what white light is, but blue light is our main thing. So you have other brands that, you know, patented technology, 15, 20 years ago to block harmful yellow light. And what Bahio does is we took that yellow light technology and we improved it. So we not only block harmful yellow light, but we block harmful blue light. So, and the biggest producer of blue light is the sun. So once you figure out how to eliminate that blue light, there's, you know, less eye fatigue, less haze. One of our big pitches early on is, you know, we just go to random guides and fishing captains around and be like, hey, dude, go wear these for 10 hours and tell me how you feel. And after it, your eyes would feel rested because you're getting less blue light. And the guy that designed our lenses, actually, he came from a blue light company, and everyone thinks it's from your phone or your computer or whatever. And he was like, no, man, it's coming from the sun. And especially when that blue light is bouncing off the water into your eyes, it's really bad for your eyes and causes eye fatigue. So if you're out there, like we were saying earlier, looking for a permit or whatever it is, you're scouring. Like when I'm out there on the flats, like I don't even have time for a water break because I'm like, oh, you could come at any moment. You know what I mean? So like you can imagine your eyes are just so dialed in. And this patented lens technology that we have, it's called Lapis. But it's been super well received, and we're a new company. You know, we're only 3 years old, and we got the opportunity to advertise with SCOFF. It's like we align because we're doing the same things. We're sort of both trying to fight these big giants in a creative manner with something small that we're building every day and figuring out. We don't really have anything set in stone. We have a great technology and a lot of cool people that work with us, but every day it's like very entrepreneurial, and like we're just figuring out the right avenues to go, and we're fighting these like crazy, not fighting, but there's all these legacy brands in the space, and people say, oh, I've heard of this one, why haven't I heard of you? It's like, well, we're new, but we're also, we have this crazy technology, and you know, we have the power of creativity, and we can really activate when we see something cool. There's less checks and balances to stop us from doing it. If we want to do something, it's like, hey man, it's 3 or 4 day turnaround. Like you want to make a super cool, whatever it is, you know what I mean? If we get enough people to say, yeah, that's cool, then we're good to rip. So it's cool to be a part of SCOFF, and you know what I mean? Have a something small that's going to grow and is fairly new. So,
well, we're very happy to have you guys and thankful. And I will say there's a testament here. There's 7 people in this house today. 6 of them are sitting at this table, and all 6 of these wore Bahias all day today on the water. The one that went to bed early because his eyes were hurting wasn't wearing Bahias. So
yeah. Also, did he catch any fish?
No.
He did not catch a fish.
I mean, dude, I don't. Sorry.
Everybody
who caught a fish today in this room was wearing Bahias.
I mean, so if you want to catch fish, wear Bahias. Just saying.
What's your favorite lens color? You guys have how many lens colors?
We have 7 different lens colors, and something we offer too, since we make everything in Florida, the lenses are, you know what I mean, cut and placed in the frames. Everything's assembled at our factory in New Smyrna. They're kind of built to order, so you can get any lens in any frame.
Gotcha.
But we have some really specialty lenses, like our Rose and Violet Mirror have been really well received.
That's the one I got.
The Violet is for like true low light. It's kind of similar to that yellow lens that you're used to, but it's actually more polarized. The polarization efficiency is higher in that lens than the yellow that you're used to. But sometimes people are so stuck in their ways. They're like, hey man, I've been wearing the yellow for years. What do you have that's like it? You try to sell them something new. They're like, no, I want the yellow. And you're like, actually man, the technology's all here. This is better than the yellow. It's just like, you need to educate the customer. So
that's your really favorite? Cool.
That's my favorite because it's like very unique.
Okay.
Like you're running the boat early in the morning, or you know what I mean? You're hanging it up at sunset. Like those fishy situations, like what we're doing today, like, hey, let's prioritize fishing first light and last light. Everything in the middle of the day is kind of like, whatever. I mean,
yeah, I hate to say we took a nap.
Yeah, it's like, exactly. Yeah, get the Violet. We also have a Rose Mirror, which you can still wear all day, but it's kind of specialized for that, like, you know, sight casting, low light. It's not about blocking all this light. It's about blocking harmful light and letting the good stuff in for you to, you know, interpret it.
Right.
Yeah, I dig those lenses. They were great. Tannic water in the glades. They for actually, sure. it was really sweet. Definitely keyed in on a few more fish.
Yeah, we've had a lot of success in the bass world as well with, you know, the Violet and the Rose, all the bed fishermen and everything. They're loving them. So
good stuff.
It's kind of a new take on your classic, you know, blue, green, copper. It's like, hey, we got 7, you know what I mean? Like go get in there, find whatever your perfect scenario is. Like you said, is it tannic water? Are you looking for hatches? You know what I mean? Right as the sun is setting, like we have a special lens for every kind of fishing you're doing, not just this like out of the box. Like here they're polarized and they might be blue or they might be green, but like just take it.
Yeah. Are you guys selling online, selling in other places? Where can people get some?
Yep. They're for sale online at bahiosunglasses.com. And I think we're in over 1,000 retailers at this point.
Oh, wow.
Obviously, we want to push you to the stores, like we were saying earlier, support your local fly shop.
Yeah.
It's super cool. They've been great to us. You know, they took a chance on us, opened up accounts, you know, big displays, placed big orders. So, like, if you can go in there and buy from them, that's badass.
Yeah. We appreciate you, man. Thanks for coming on here and talking about, you know, some stories, the work you've done with us, and then also the stuff with Bahia. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Also, thanks for you know, y'all are a sponsor, can't talk, sponsor, supporter of the Emergence Convergence that we're going to talk about now.
Yeah. Hank?
Emergence Convergence? What?
Why don't you tell folks again what's going on?
So, way, way back, I believe the year was 1803.
Sounds right.
221 years ago, there was this guy, right? His name was, what was it? Thomas Jefferson. And he decided to lead our country. He thought he'd be the best man for it. He wrote our Declaration of Independence. That was a little bit before 1803. But in 1803, after Thomas Jefferson was elected the president, two broods of cicadas emerged at the same time. And this year, it's happening again. For the first time since Thomas Jefferson saw the two cicadas.
History has it that he was a fly fisherman and fished for carp with cicada patterns.
History says a lot of things about Thomas Jefferson, and we're not at liberty to discuss most of those things. So I will just talk about the bugs. So the great southern brood is scheduled to emerge in the south, and we're thinking, according to experts, entomologists we've talked to at universities such as University of North Georgia in Dahlonega, we've talked to an expert named Evan Lampert up there. He kind of gave us a cicada forecast in our last issue in Scott 50, and he told us that the Piedmont region is going to be absolutely tore up with bugs. The Piedmont is really anything above, anything at or above the fall line before you get to kind of the highlands or the mountains. We're talking about basically Montgomery, Alabama to Columbia, South Carolina. And even further north. And then there's going to be some kind of like, you know, Brood X, there was a big emergence in eastern Tennessee on the western slope of the Appalachians. There's going to be quite a few bugs hatching in the upstate in South Carolina and in Georgia. They're expecting the Coosa Basin from Rome all the way down to Montgomery to be very, very productive. And, you know, in our experience, I haven't fished cicadas very much, but the things that eat cicadas are things that eat anything, such as bass, carp. You know, the unpicky eaters, the generalists, are going to be out absolutely destroying whatever lands on the surface. So we're excited that you guys are starting to sign up for this tournament we're running. We've got around, I think, 50 people signed up so far.
Wow.
We're hoping for close to 1,000 times more people than that.
Yeah,
we're
close. Right.
But it is free.
It's free to sign right. up. There's, I mean, we have like over $15,000 of prizes
already
to give away.
Yeah.
So it's kind of stupid not to participate if you like free stuff. It's also going to be way fun because there are a lot of different ways to participate. You can either go fishing like normal people do, or you can write a song about cicadas. You can come up with a cool cicada recipe. There's like a million different ways to win prizes. And if you can think of a new way that to earn a prize, let us know. If you do something cool with cicadas, makes cool cicada art, whatever, send us an email, post it, use the hashtag convergence or emergence convergence. Use the hashtag emergence convergence. And tag Scoff in it, and we'll hook you up with some gear because we're just trying to spread the cicada gospel.
Community.
Community.
Yeah. Yep.
Drink. I didn't say community. Shit, I just did.
I had to.
Oh, you did again.
So we got a bunch of cool prizes.
There's going to be prizes. There's going to be
parties.
That's one thing that we're kind of starting to solidify. So this is all kind of, you know, Scoff doesn't have anything figured out until it's over. But the cool thing about this tournament is it's going to be a couple weeks long, and at the very end of it, we're going to do, since it's a virtual tournament, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, you can participate anywhere. We're going to sort of have like some cultural hubs, some fly shops that we've, you know, that we have a relationship with, have agreed to host end of tournament parties for us. So what we'll do is kind of announce the tournament winners. We'll have giveaways and stuff at those events. And it'll just be a fun way to kind of like wrap things up, because it'll be the last time in our lives that we ever get to experience an event like this. There will be more cicada brood hatches. Let's be clear about that. But this will be the last time during our lifetimes that these two broods emerge at the same time, which is cool.
And if people want to sign up, how do they do it?
If you want to sign up, go to southerncultureonthefly.com/the-emergence-convergence.
Or they can click a link in issue 50.
Or they can just read the damn magazine.
And go all
the way back. And there's hyperlinks all up in there that they can click.
Yes. It's good stuff. Use the hyperlink.
It's good stuff.
I want to see some cicada recipes come out of this.
Yes.
I am really looking forward to cicada recipes. We published one in the last issue that John's mom plagiarized from... from
Thanks,
a cookbook,
Mom.
But we appreciate it anyway.
In my experience, just olive oil and garlic, man. That's all you need. A little crunch, not too bad.
You might have.
What do they taste like?
No.
Well, so we don't keep rambling. Thank you guys for listening. We appreciate all of our subscribers out there. People like Declan, our sponsors, and we'll catch you guys next time. Scoffcast out.
Later.
Cicada Mania.